The whales that spend time in Alaska waters are valued for many reasons. The centuries of sustenance they bring to Alaska's first people in the Arctic, their prominent place in the ocean ecosystem, the thrill of seeing them alongside vessels for tourists, and sometimes, when one washes up on a shoreline, as recently happened in Anchorage, curious onlookers get a chance to see one up close. What do biologists hope to learn about the health of Alaska whales and ocean conditions? We'll hear about the work being done today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Laurie Townsend. Whales are incredible mammals, enormous, mysterious, intelligent. They share language and songs. A lot of art and music has been inspired by them, and Alaska Native communities in the northern part of our state have relied on them for food, tools, clothing, and spiritual connection forever. The popularity of a fin whale that washed up near urban Alaska offers a unique cultural window for scientists, Native artists, and regular Alaskans. What is being learned about the health of Alaska whales and the oceans they live in? Here to help us understand more about the whales that live in the waters around Alaska, how scientists perform necropsies when they wash up on our shores, and what they hope to learn are Natalie Rouse. Natalie is a necropsy biologist with Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services at UAA. She's in the studio with us today, as is Barbara Mahoney, who is a National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Assistant Stranding Coordinator for Western Alaska. And on the phone from Juneau is Mandy Keough. Mandy is the Alaska Regional Stranding Coordinator for NOAA. Welcome, all of you.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So, Barbara, I want to start with you. How did you first hear about this particular whale, the fin whale?
We have NOAA Fisheries has a stranding hotline, and people can call that number. And in doing so, it starts our contact names of me. So it called me and said, hey, someone called in about a dead whale. At the time, it was unidentified. And this was late, actually. It was last Saturday, the 16th. At 10 p.m., and so I called in the reporter, and she said that she had heard from a friend about a dead whale along the coastal trail and that it was near Westchester. So we kind of started contacting folks here about doing a response on the following day, Sunday.
And so did you go out? Were you there on Sunday? And what was your first impression when you saw it?
Well, yes, we went out, and you can't miss it. And by then already we saw quite a bit of foot traffic, not as it proceeded in the next couple of days. But yeah, it was very large. And when we got close, we could identify it more as a baleen whale, meaning that it's not a tooth whale and has the baleen structure, and identified it as a fin whale. We maybe have jumped to that conclusion, but it was correct. And then we I went out with Natalie and her volunteer crew and some others that came with us, and we started doing some measurements. It was pretty magnificent. I mean, it's almost 50 feet. We measured it about 47 plus some change.
That's incredible. And you mentioned that there had already been some foot traffic, but did you think or expect that it would become the sort of community attraction that it has?
It exceeded my expectations. I mean, we've had other large whales strand in and around Anchorage, down by Girdwood and Turnagain Arm, that people could drive to or do a long hike to, like at Kincaid down by Point Campbell. And that kind of makes it a little bit challenging to access. But this one was just so easy. I figured it would be crowded. But the cold, I thought, might keep people away.
Not Alaskans.
No. And in the daylight, too. I mean, we've heard of people, and I've seen people go in there with their headlights with their headlamps and flashlights, you know, to hike out in the dark. So that's pretty dedicated.
Yeah, absolutely. Natalie, talk about the work you do for National Marine Fisheries Service and others. You are independent, correct?
Yes, I work for Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services, and we have a grant that runs through the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And we're tasked with responding to dead stranded whales and other marine mammals. So we will go out and examine the whales or the other marine mammals, or they may come to our lab. Just depends how big they are and the feasibility. And we're looking for we do dissections for cause of death investigations, as well as collect samples for various research projects for a variety of researchers across the country.
What was your first experience with this particular whale?
I went out on Sunday with Barb, and just got to see how big it was. And I have worked on a fin whale before, but they're one of the largest whales that we work on. So it's really, really amazing to be able to see such a big whale and so close to town. Makes my job in some ways a lot easier, in other ways harder to be able to work.
Does your organization only work for Alaska scientists and people here in the state?
We only respond to Alaska marine mammals, but there's scientists all over the United States and some in different parts of the world that are working on projects that involve whales from Alaska.
Talk a little bit about what a necropsy is and what you're collecting and documenting to help determine death and other things.
A necropsy is just a term. Most people are familiar with the term autopsy. So that the root of that word just means self. So anything that's not done on a human can be called a necropsy or a necropsy. Both ways to say it are correct. And it's just looking at something that is dead and examining it. So we go through the body systematically. We look at start with the external part of the body, and then we work our way in through each of the systems of the body. So we want to look at the respiratory system, the gastrointestinal system. We look at the nervous system, the musculoskeletal system, kind of piece by piece, just to systematically look at what might be going on with the animal.
And we'll talk more about what you may be learning in a bit here. But Mandy, I want to get you in on this conversation, of course. NOAA has a 24-hour number to call if someone sees a stranded or entangled or otherwise distressed marine mammal. Someone called that number for this whale. Walk us through what happens after a call like that comes in.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, our hotline covers the entire state of Alaska, and it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week. You'll be connected with an operator who will collect some basic information from you. And what that they are looking for is the location of where the stranding is occurring, what you're seeing. So is it a dead animal? Is it a large whale? Is it an abandoned pinniped pup? And that helps us connect with local stranding network members throughout the state. So AVPS is, as Natalie says, has a Prescott grant that's awarded through NOAA Fisheries to their organization to help support their stranding response. And then there's also they have a stranding agreement, which gives them the authority to go out and respond when there are stranded marine mammals. And we have similar partners throughout the state. So if you call from Ukiavik or Nome, depending on where you are, if we have a local responder, we'll try and connect them with you or connect them with the carcass that you may have been reporting. But besides the location, we'd like to know if you have any photos. Photos are really helpful. Barb mentioned that when we first got the call, we had that it was a whale. And in Upper Cook Inlet, we often see Cook Inlet beluga whales that strand. But the photo that the person who observed the animal sent us told us really quickly that it was not a beluga whale, that it was a really large baleen whale. And so those photos help us understand what kind of a response we can do. So we're looking for things like the size of the animal, the location, whether you see any gear or marine debris. So is there anything entangling the animal? And then also any photos are super helpful. And then we'll connect with the local responder in the area. The other thing is, with Alaska being so large, there's a lot of the coastlines that we don't have responders that are available or can easily access. So sometimes when the public reports to us what they're seeing and the photos they provide, that's our only opportunity to collect information on that event. But we can gain a lot of details from the photos. We can often identify the species, sometimes the age, the sex of the animal. We can see some obvious injuries like killer whale predation or whether there's any gear on the animal. So I can't understate how important the photos are. And on dead animals, you can approach them and take photos. You don't want to move them or touch them. You know, they are a dead animal. But if it's a live animal, you'd want to stay 100 yards or more away while you collect your photos.
Yeah, that makes sense to stay safe. How often, Mandy, is the 24-hour hotline used, and has that changed through the years? Are you getting more or less calls?
Yeah. So like a lot of things in Alaska, it's very seasonal. So during the summer, where we have longer days, more people on the water, we get most of our stranding reports between like May and September. Cooking the belugas, we do see those strandings occur more in the fall, but it is very seasonal, with the peak strandings being and entanglements being reported probably in June and July. And that is probably somewhat an artifact of just people are out more, they're on the water, there's more people around, and there's longer daylight, so there's a better chance that you'd see an animal. And over the years, we have seen an increase in the number of people using and reporting to the stranding hotline. And that may be just an artifact of public out, you know, people being aware to call and report the animals. And so it's actually probably a positive that we're seeing more animals being reported, because when people are coming across these carcasses or distressed and entangled marine mammals, they have an idea that someone needs to be called. And either they have that hotline available with them, or they can quickly Google it and find out who to call.
All right. Thank you for that. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska. And today we're talking about the health of whales and the health of oceans in Alaska waters, as we talk with biologists regarding the fin whale that washed up near Anchorage recently. And lots of folks have been marching down to the beach to observe it. A necropsy has been done on the whale, and now we're waiting for results to see what these tests can reveal about the health of it. In the studio with me today is Natalie Rouse. Natalie is a necropsy biologist with Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services. And Barbara Mahoney is a NOAA Assistant Stranding Coordinator for Western Alaska. And on the line from Juneau is Mandy Keough, who is NOAA's Alaska Regional Stranding Coordinator. All right, let's go to the phones for just a moment. Stu is in Eagle River. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think it was about 2001, there was a gray whale that washed up right next to the highway in Turnagain Arm, just north of the 20-mile river. I was going on a kayaking trip to Prince William Sound with a group of people, and we saw that, so we had to pull over and watch, and the biologists were there pulling out the intestinal tract and, I guess, looking at it. And right behind them was a bunch of natives. I think they're Inupiat, with a wooden box with a bunch of ulus in it. And they were getting on top and taking some, I guess, muktuk. And one of the people in our group jumped up there with them and started carving with a Swiss Army knife. And they just handed him an ulu and showed him how to do it. And then he took a chunk of this, it looked like gray skin color stuff and then cantaloupe colored stuff to the road, and everyone started chomping on it. Grease was running down their chins. I mean, it was an experience. But I don't believe that guy that jumped up there was a native. My question is, did he violate the law when the natives kind of waved him up? And the other story I have is being around, I think it was a humpback in Whale Bay in Prince William Sound. You get close to him, you can feel there's like a magnetism or a force or something. And I noticed it's the same feeling you get around elephants. It's this animal actually followed us in kayaks, making sounds similar to a dog. That was very unnerving. I wasn't comfortable with that animal. It seemed to be people habituated. I don't know if anybody else has noticed that. But anyhow, it's, they're mystical animals, and I'm really glad that one washed up for everybody to enjoy. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the story, Stu. I saw Barbara nodding her head as you were talking about the gray whale experience. Were you out there, Barbara?
I do remember that event, and that was a live stranding at first. Stu, you might remember that it had been in Turnagain Arm for a bit, but it eventually died there. So it was very fresh when the local community of Alaska Native were able to salvage what they could from that. So we know it allows that, but we don't like promote it because we don't know the cause of death. We don't know the animal's health. But you are correct that Alaska Natives can salvage stranded marine mammals for subsistence foods and for handicrafts.
Yeah, and so just letting people make their own decision in that regard, I guess, is how you approach something like that?
Correct. Someone else said, and they know better than we do about food safety. Yep.
Sure. Yeah. So for all of you.
And just to add
go
to
ahead,
that,
please.
So Stu specifically asked whether if the person was not Alaska Native, then that is a violation of the law. So the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act, in this case, because it is an endangered fin whale, if you are not an authorized responder, like AVPS and their volunteers, or an Alaska Native and there's a quarter by blood, you cannot collect or salvage any marine mammal parts from a carcass. But it is legal for Alaska Natives to be salvaging those tissues, either for handicraft, the baleen, or for consumption if they feel it's safe.
And so that thank you for clarifying that point, that it didn't matter that the group around this gentleman was Alaska Native and said, here, help us out. It was still not legal for him to do that, even though he was in the company of other folks who were legally doing that.
Yeah, unless he was working with an organization like researchers who were authorized and he was a volunteer or associated with them, then he shouldn't have been collecting it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for that clarification. For all of you, how many varieties of whales are found in Cook Inlet, especially Upper Cook Inlet? Through the years, I foolishly thought we only primarily had belugas.
So
Barbara, please.
We regularly see belugas, and in the past, we have regularly seen harbor porpoises. But now with some projects around Kinnegarm or the road construction along Turnagain, we have protected species observers, so they're doing better monitoring. And those are confirmed along with stellar sea lions that are not that common, harbor seals are. And we also have reports of killer whales and humpback whales. And that has been observed by these observers as well as, you know, sometimes stranding. Mm-hmm. But when you get down towards the lower reaches of Cook Inlet with a more marine, then really we're getting everything that can be found in the Shelikof Gulf, Alaska, most everything. Because fin whales are not common, but they visit that lower Cook Inlet. Gray whales are there, humpback whales. We get Dall's porpoise, harbor porpoises. And then other people call in other things that I don't know what they were, but they said it wasn't a killer whale or it wasn't a humpback whale, but it was just a large whale. So we have some unidentified as well.
A lot of them around then.
Yep.
What have you been able to learn so far about this particular fin whale that washed up near Anchorage? Have you been able to tell? It sounds like it didn't look injured, so it wasn't struck by some kind of a vessel. Is that correct?
So I'll just jump in on that really quickly, and then
sure.
Maybe Natalie can add on to what she was seeing. So as we discussed earlier, like the conditions that folks were necropsying the animal were in really challenging, besides the fact that it was, you know, single digit temperatures, wind blowing, and that really caused the whale to start freezing while they were actually sampling and collecting animals. So they were not able to do a complete examination of the carcass to rule out blunt force or any other trauma that may have been seen with the bones. And that was because they just physically could not cut into the whale at that time. And if you are someone who went out to the whale, you'll notice that there's these windows that have been cut into the whale. And Natalie can speak more about this, but that's a specific protocol that was developed by some of the pathologists with Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services and other pathologists across the country. And they call it the window method. And when you have limited time or other constraints like temperature and freezing temperature, it provides you access to those body systems that Natalie had mentioned, but we weren't able to do a complete examination to rule out blunt trauma. It's an unknown right now. There was no obvious injuries to the external of the animal. And it's also one reason why, if the conditions do allow, the Stranding Network members and Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services may make an attempt to go back out to the whale to try and do some of the more examinations that we would normally have done to try and assess whether or not there was trauma to the animal.
So beyond not being able to determine cause of death yet, what are you learning?
Well, we know that it is a juvenile whale based on the size of the whale. It's a female. And we know that the whale had eaten recently. So it had contents in its stomach. It had feces in its GI tract. So that's a sign of a recent meal. We have found potentially some fat around the heart when we got in there. So if that checks out, you know, we hope to examine that under the microscope, which we haven't done yet, then that would indicate that the whale had some fat stores. The blubber layer the blubber was a little bit grainy, and sometimes that can mean that the animal is starting to lose some of its conditioning, so it has some conflicting signs of being in good health and being in suboptimal condition. So that's where we've gotten started. We have set out several tissues for pathogen testing. So we're looking forward to getting those results back, and so we can just rule that stuff out or figure out if that's something might be going on with this whale. So so far
it's a mystery.
So far we don't know. Yeah, we don't know why it died.
And how long will it take to get these results back?
It takes weeks to months to maybe a full year to get everything back. We have several different labs that are able to run things pretty quickly, but then we also have researchers that are, you know, usually one or two people, and it's kind of in a long list of animals that they're looking at. So, we'll have information trickling in for up to a year.
And just to add on to that, one
yes,
of the reasons
please,
why
Mandy.
It also takes so long is as the analysis comes in, you know, Natalie and Dr. Burek with AVPS may decide that there's additional samples or additional tests that should be run. So as you're getting information in, you might send out additional samples to try and determine what you're seeing in one is causing. Like, you know, if you see a histological change, it might be indicative of an infection, and maybe you start going down to look for that in more in depth. So it's kind of an evolving process as the results come in.
Absolutely.
I want to go to a email here that we had some comments in. And as we noted in the beginning of the program, there was a ceremony held yesterday, Monday, for the whale on the beach. And we had a note from Wendy who says, "First newscast I saw showed children sliding on the whale's tail. It made me uncomfortable." She writes, "Last night, a group of folks from Alaska Native Heritage were giving a prayer in reverence. What a contrast. People should be allowed to view and gently touch, but this creature should be respected in its death," Wendy writes. Did you see anything that made you a little uncomfortable? I know, Barbara, you said you saw quite a different group of people with different gear, some of it appropriate, some of it seeming like they weren't dressed for the conditions.
We were there, and I did kind of wear a yellow vest, and I did kind of talk to people about what they could and couldn't do. So I think during the events when Nally was there with her team on Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday of last week, and then I followed up on Wednesday and Thursday, I had heard about the disrespect. I had heard about the climbing, and I had heard about the sliding, which I also feel, you know, very sad. And I don't think this is a majestic animal, and it deserves respect, I think, in its death as well as in its life. I did not see that, but I think I may have inhibited that kind of behavior. I did talk to people about what they could and couldn't do in terms of, you know, you can't collect baleen unless you're Alaska Native. I have since heard that the tail has been cut off. I've since heard that I've seen video and pictures, same thing, of people climbing on it and sliding on it. I'm a little saddened by that, but I didn't really see that when I was there. But again, I introduced myself to not announcement, but people I talked to, I did introduce myself as Noah. So that might have prohibited people from sure. taking a stance.
Yeah, probably a bit of a deterrent. Present,
yep.
presence that you had there. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Debbie is in Homer. Hello, Debbie.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Did you have a
Thank
question?
You for taking my call. I just wanted to commend the women on the phone and everyone with the Stranding Network for all of their tireless efforts. They are incredibly respectful, dedicated individuals, and their teams are just incredible. They're diligent. They work very long hours, oftentimes in pretty extreme conditions, and I just really can't say enough about how grateful we all are for everything they do.
Well, thank you for the call, Debbie. It was very nice. You know, I've wondered, too, about, I know that you're a small organization, you're a small group. How is it to stay in business and keep doing this, what is clearly very important work, but is it seen as important enough that you don't have to worry about funding in the future?
Yeah, it is a difficult endeavor. I am mostly funded by a Prescott grant. That's a federal grant, and I reapply for that grant every year. So if it makes it into the federal budget, then they offer it, and then I'm able to apply for it. And it's a year-by-year thing. So I've been very fortunate to be in this position since 2019, and it's been funded every year, but it's a competitive grant, and I never know if I'm going to get it.
And how is this work seen within NOAA, the importance of it and funding
concerns? So we're very appreciative, and with Alaska Veterinary Pathology Service, which is Nellie and Dr. Kathy Burek, and, you know, as the and staff of that group. But they lead a very dedicated group of volunteers. And to have those volunteers, you need someone, of course, to work with them and train them. And that's part of all of what they do. And although located here in the Cook Inlet Anchorage area, you know, they do work with statewide. They are the people, the vets, that can fly out to Dutch Harbor or down to Southeast Alaska, you know, to get more information. And what we are trying to always find out is, you know, individual animal health. So here's a fin whale. What can we learn about this fin whale? But it's not very common for fin whales to strand and to be, quote unquote, fresh, you know, which is recently dead, and the condition is healthy. Well, I shouldn't say, the conditions are good for sampling. And a lot of times they've been floating in the water, so by the time they get in, their advanced decomposition, there's a whole lot less we can learn. We were inhibited by the cold temperatures of the animal. I think people suffered through the cold, but as the animal froze up, it was more challenging. So we are learning about the animal health, and from that we can learn about population health, and from that we can learn about the ocean health as well. But yeah, we have a bunch of dedicated volunteers throughout the state. We have some receiving Prescott grants that Nellie talked about, but they're really pretty much the lead, and Nellie's responsive to just about everybody that calls in about something for sampling.
All right. Thank you for that, Barbara. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the health of whales in Alaska waters and, by extension, the health of the ocean as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. In the studio with me today is Natalie Rouse. Natalie is a necropsy biologist with Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services. Also in the studio is Barbara Mahoney. Barbara works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, as an assistant stranding coordinator for Western Alaska. And Mandy Keough is on the line from Juneau. Mandy is the Alaska Regional Stranding Coordinator for NOAA. Susan writes, hello, can your guests address the possibility that the whale was affected by Navy sonar exercises that do impact hearing and may lead to lack of direction and stranding? Barbara, please.
We can talk a little bit about that in the sense that it hasn't and isn't occurring in Cook Inlet, and it's not occurring in the Shelikof Strait. And the Navy does work with NOAA Fisheries for the permitting for their exercises and operations with that, with the intent, again, not to harm or harass these marine mammals. So for this particular fin whale, that's unlikely to have been the cause of of the animal's death, and definitely not as sonar didn't cause the animal's death, and also probably didn't affect its migration or movements into Cook Inlet, because there's nothing happening here in the lower Cook Inlet for Navy exercises.
If animals are affected by sonar, or when they're affected by sonar, is it a temporary thing that happens, or does it?
It's all about the noise. We get into something I'm less familiar with, but it's all about the noise, frequency and decibel levels, right? And in terms of, and then the animal's communications of, high, medium, low frequencies itself.
Mm. All right. And there's also, there's probably a big difference between species for sound and sonar for whether or not they're affected by it or likely to be affected by it. Mm. So some species are, like beaked whales, are a concern with sonar, with mass strandings and things like that, to look at whether or not there might be any damage to the ears or other areas that would indicate there was sound exposure.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about fin whales generally. What's known about them, both in Alaska and in other parts of the world?
One thing I'll jump in here. But,
please do, Barbara.
But one thing that is pretty fascinating as people go out there, I mean, this animal is almost 50 feet long. It's 47. This is young, maybe young of the year, definitely only no more than a couple years old. They're born about 21 feet. This is the size of an adult gray whale. This is double the size of an adult minke whale. It's in the size of a adult humpback whale. So in terms of, size, these are the second largest. Outside of blue whales get towards 100 feet. These guys, fin whales, get towards 70 plus up to 85 feet.
Wow!
I know. They're born at 21 feet. So even, and that's, the biology that we can find. But even with that length, I mean, it grew within a year another, dozen feet. So it's pretty majestic and marvelous at these animals and what they can do. They're usually found at the shelf breaks, Gulf of Alaska. They'll be found further down south of around the Kodiak shelf break area. But they do migrate. They are regularly observed in Alaska, including the Gulf, offshore usually, Bering Sea, and now they're starting to make forays into the Beaufort Sea. Our folks doing surveys for bowhead whales and other marine mammals have been seeing more and more fin whales in the Beaufort as there's less ice, and they're moving into that for feeding. Mm. But so they work on, small prey, the krill, the small fishes and such like that to feed on. But they're individual, or they're in small groups. So I think they're also very hard to count because of the fact. We have seen them in our beluga surveys in Lower Cook Inlet. And again, we're talking one animal maybe in the whole lower inlet and not a big group or a big pod either.
Do they normally travel alone, or are they usually in pods?
They can be in small. You can see them individually. I looked it up. You can see them individually, maybe in a couple, but really no more than like six or eight in a group.
Mandy, two acts apply to this particular whale that washed up on the Anchorage beach. Remind us of what actions are triggered by the Marine Mammal Protection Act of 1972 and the Endangered Species Act of 1973 with a whale such as this fin whale.
Yeah, so they somewhat cover any marine mammal in Alaska is protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And that applies whether it's a rare animal like this fin whale or a more common harbor seal. And one of the things that it protects is that you cannot disturb or cause a change in their behavior. So that's one reason why we suggest when you see an animal that might be ashore, like an abandoned harbor seal pup, you need to maintain your distance of 100 yards because you don't want to disturb or cause that animal to flush into the water, because that is not allowed under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And then the Endangered Species Act is just another layer that applies to any animal that is listed as threatened or endangered. And so this limits, basically it doubles the same limitations that you can do. So it protects it both under the Endangered Species Act as well as the Marine Mammal Protection Act. But both acts broadly eliminate the disturbance of marine mammals. And that is also why you can't collect any tissues or baleen from an animal from a marine mammal carcass unless you are authorized, like an authorized responder or qualify for an Alaska Native.
And Barbara mentioned that fin whales are traveling farther north, that they're being seen up by the bowhead populations. Can fin whales be harvested by Alaska Native people, or are they not able to be harvested?
I'm going to defer to Barb, because that's more her
area. Barbara.
There's not a a quota through the International Whaling Commission that allows for the harvest of fin whales.
Okay.
But as a tradition, anything on the beach has been salvaged by Alaska Natives for use, as Mandy mentioned, for subsistence and for handicraft purposes. But no, there's no hunting of fin whales.
Okay, so if one washes up, it's fair game, but otherwise they can't be hunted.
Correct.
Natalie, a humpback washed up near Kincaid Park in Anchorage in 2017. Is it unusual for humpbacks to be this far up the inlet?
It's not incredibly common, but it is seen. And as Barbara was mentioning, the observers have seen humpbacks here and there. So, no, it's not something you're going to see every day or even every summer, but it does happen.
Was a necropsy done on that whale?
It was, yes.
And what was learned about that?
That's a good question. I haven't looked up that whale in a long time. I was there.
That's all right.
A lot of us were there. We always are able to learn quite a lot from the whale. So we learned the age, the sex. We collected baleen, and that baleen was most likely run for stable isotope analysis. So we could see the trophic layers of what that whale was eating. And that's done by individual specific researchers. But as Barb was saying, you know, this data is compiled, so we learn things about each individual whale, and most of them, you know, the broader things that we learn are over time. So we're adding up what we learn from each whale, and the data sets are over time. And so maybe we don't find something groundbreaking from one whale, but altogether we really do learn quite a lot.
We've been talking about the fact that pieces are being taken off the fin whale that's on the beach here in Anchorage now, pieces other than necropsy samples. Natalie, you had said in an earlier interview that you'd like people to leave it intact except for Alaska Native harvest. What else would you like to learn by observing the whale while it decomposes?
It would be really great for us to be able to get a look at the bones. So this whale might wash out before we ever would get a chance to do that. But if it doesn't wash away, or if it washes away and lands somewhere that we can access it again, we would really like to get a look at the bones to see if we see any signs of trauma underneath.
When you do necropsies, do you take bone samples to sample those as well, or is it mainly tissues and organs?
It's mainly tissues and organs. We will take bones in some cases. There is some information that we can get, and it just depends on the conditions and what we're able to do. We sort of have a priority list based on what we can access. So as you can imagine, with a smaller carcass that we could bring into the lab, it would be pretty easy to take a bone, and so we would certainly do so because we'd have no constraints. But with this whale, we didn't. That wasn't high on our priority list. Based on what we could access in the time that we had.
Barbara, years ago when I was a beat reporter, I would call you every year and
right.
do a story about the annual Cook Inlet beluga count. Those animals have, their numbers have dropped from more than 1,000 in the 70s to I think they're around 300 now in this very distinct pod in Cook Inlet. Through your years of research, what have you learned about why this pod just kind of hovers at that number and doesn't either recover or wink out?
That is, as we talk in the office, is, you know, the million-dollar question. You know, there was a significant harvest on these animals through the 90s, documented through the 80s from conversations. So it did decline with some subsistence hunting and harvest. That stopped, and we still haven't, for over 20 years, we haven't recovered the population. So there's been a lot of researches to look at the animal health. Alaska Vet Pathology Services, they've been instrumental in collecting data and information on animal health. The public have been fabulous about calling up about strandings or dead on the beach, 5 strandings in Turnagain. We had someone from Hope call in about, you know, one animal observed off of her house just this summer. We had that entangled beluga whale that people were, you know, monitoring. Great volunteer effort to try to track that so there could be a response to disentangle it. So, I mean, and then we have belugas count. So the community of Cook Inlet has been very active and involved in kind of understanding or providing information to NOAA and to the stranding program, you know, to better understand. And so we're getting some better information on animal health of belugas. Prey is a big deal, you know, is there food? Is there enough food? What's happening in Cook Inlet for that? Where do they winter? You know, we had some satellite-tagged belugas from the early 2000s, and we got some indication of that, but we're getting additional more, and we're learning quite a bit from acoustic studies, you know, with different PAMs, because passive acoustic monitoring devices, because if we put them out there, then people, you know, in the wintertime, we're getting ideas of what they're doing and where they are. So we don't have an answer, but we're finding out more and more about these animals. And they were actually lower than 300 just a few years ago. So now we're up to 300, and I think 31 with a survey next year. So maybe that's...
So there's been a bit of an uptick?
Yes, and we've had those before. So I'm optimistically hopeful, but I'm not going to say it's a sure thing. But yeah, I like to think that, you know, through the efforts. And I have to say, again, it's community-driven, but industry has been helping as well. And that's with protected species observers, you know, making sure that they're not harming them acoustically or physically, yes. Mm.
All right, we are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue with calls and questions about Alaska's whales as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Carl is in Homer. Hello, Carl.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to talk about orcas and killer whales that are attacking vessels and sinking vessels and actually killing people off of Gibraltar, Canary Islands, and off that Atlantic area. There's been over 80 reports, and there's the whole world is kind of on edge over there with people sailing out of Europe. And I just was hoping that it doesn't migrate to Alaskan waters. But there's an epidemic going on with recent orca attacks.
Hmm. So in Alaska, we've not had any reports of any interactions of orcas attacking vessels. No, our orcas can depredate people that are fishing or working in the waters. But within the Alaska, and they are a separate population than the population you referenced, we've not had any reports of any orcas attacking vessels, sinking vessels, or anything like that.
All right. Thank you for that. I want to go back to the email questions here for just a moment. Barbara, you were talking about the Cook Inlet beluga population and their care and what has to happen when they're in the inlet. And here's a question from Barbara asking, what impact do seismic surveys have on Cook Inlet belugas? Does it affect juveniles' hearing?
The intention of the Remedial Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act is, of course, not to harm or lethally or non-lethal marine mammals. There's a lot of other things. But one of that requirement means that there's permitting required for any activity in Cook Inlet for listed species, the Cook Inlet beluga is endangered, the endangered western stock of Stellar sea lions. So we do consult with any project in Cook Inlet on, you know, and seismic is one of it. So they have observers, and the idea for that is, of course, not to harm belugas or other marine mammals in the area, and there's the shutdowns, and there's monitoring to make sure that the loud noise and any operations are not in the area that would, in the distance, in the make sure that belugas are distant from any operations. So we think we're doing a good job about that. That may be part of why the population may slightly be increasing, is these protected species observers to make sure that, again, the operations, whether it's dredging, whether it's pile driving, whether it's seismic, is not harming these animals.
Natalie and Barbara, you've both been to the site of the whale. Hundreds, if not thousands, of Alaskans, other Alaskans, have now seen this whale up close. What do you think are the potential benefits of that itself?
I really think getting, I mean, it's the attraction of, you know, zoos and aquaria. It's, you know, getting close and personal. And there were a lot of young kids there, and some were interested, some were cold. There was people coming out with crutches, people coming out with, you know, with their own bikes. So, I mean, there's a challenge.
Really and wanted to get there.
and there is an interest. And I think that kind of builds a community. And it's a community of respect, hopefully, for these animals and, you know, and really want to protect them. And so I see a lot of benefit of that. And some people, you know, Natalie mentioned it, and I'll mention it too, that when you get out there, people are just inquiring with questions. And most of it is about concern. What happened? What's going to happen? How did this animal do this? Why did this animal do this? So, you know, I see the passion of people with the environment and with this particular fin whale.
Given that interest, what would you want people to know about how they can actually get involved in a way that's helpful for science as volunteers? What can they do?
Well, I am going to put in a plug for our stranding hotline, and that number is 877-925-7773.
And we'll link to that on our site.
Thank you. And you can also just, as Mandy mentioned, you can just look up, you know, stranded in Alaska, and that number will come in. And if people can call that number throughout the year, including November 16th, you know, we will make an effort, strong effort to respond to that. And again, our goals are to understand the animal and document their stranding events, understand the population through these individual animals, and then get an understanding of the ocean health. And I really think that with the events that are happening in Alaska, from climate change to, you know, the blob that came up in 2014-16 to harmful algal blooms that seem to be more prevalent now, I mean, this is something that helps and benefits us all to understand what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Mandy, yes, please, go ahead, pick it up there.
I was just going to say, separate from if you're, you know, because whether or not you see a stranded marine or an entangled marine mammal is very opportunistic, but there are other ways to get involved. You know, different schools have like an ocean guardian program, or they do beach cleanups. So anything that would help improve the environment and the waterways that these animals are living in would be a benefit to them. So there are other more directed efforts that if you're interested in, or if your students are interested in, that you could try and play a role in.
The bowhead population north of us in the Arctic seems to be healthy and thriving, with numbers robust enough to sustain an annual harvest. Is there something about bowheads or baleen whales generally that they're more resilient to changing ocean conditions, or why are they doing so well?
Yeah. So I can start, and then maybe
please,
Natalie,
Mandy.
Or Barb. I will say the changing marine environment, especially Barb mentioned that heat wave that came through, or the blob in 2014-2016. We did have an unusual mortality event declared by NOAA during that time period, and that involved fin whales and humpback whales. So there was an increase in number of dead stranded fin whales and humpback whales in Alaska and in British Columbia. And through the necropsies and the sampling that involved stranding partners, including AVPS, it was determined that there was not a definitive cause of why those animals were increased in strandings, but it was likely due to food and prey. So that heat wave caused a whole shift in the Gulf of Alaska and the food web. And we saw mass mortalities with birds and other marine mammals, including fin whales and humpback. So, and some of the observations that people have made about gray whales or different humpback whales being in the upper inlet, it could be those animals are moving into new areas following food sources. So baleen whales are likely sensitive to these changes that we're seeing. It could just be that the bowheads up in the Arctic have not fully seen the effects that we've seen down in the Gulf of Alaska, or we just haven't detected it yet.
All right, Mandy, I wanted to ask quickly, we only have a couple minutes left here, but you had said in an earlier interview that there's only been two previous fin whale strandings in the last 15 years. How mysterious.
In the Upper Cook Inlet, yeah.
Okay. And how mysterious
is this? So throughout
Alaska,
there's been about 36.
Oh, okay. Okay. So just unusual in Upper Cook Inlet, but not so much in other parts of the state.
It's still pretty rare if you think about only 36 whales, and those 15 years included that unusual mortality event. So we saw an uptick. Fin whale strandings in Alaska are generally fairly low reported. But in the Upper Cook Inlet, they're even more rare.
So in our final minute here, we had an email from a Seward resident who said in 2015, a fin whale was struck and killed by a cruise ship. The whale was necropsied, buried on private property on the east side of Resurrection Bay in Seward. Will this whale be dug up? The writer asks, how much longer can it remain buried and still be of value to scientists? Any knowledge of this whale?
Yes.
Buried whale?
Yes, and actually I was talking to the Alaska Sea Life Center about that recently, well, within the past year, and talking to the University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum of the North, who would be very interested in collecting those bones. And it's now seems to be an economic thing that because they're buried, it's going to be requiring some heavy equipment to get out there and dig it up. So right now it's on hold until there's a funding source. But we expect, because of the multiple years that have passed, that the tissues and material and the soft tissues are probably gone from these bones. And when they dig it up, it'll be just the bones only.
That is fascinating. You know, it reminded me of the whale on the beach here in Anchorage, as we have been discussing, will likely go out with tides in December. But are there times when other methods have had to be used to move a dead whale? It was a long time ago, 1970 in Oregon, when they famously blew up a dead whale and people were there with their picnics to watch and had dead whale meat sandwiches, sadly.
One thing we're lucky about in Alaska is the fact that a lot of our beaches are remote. And so these animals, you know, strand on it. They're necropsied by Nellie, her team, or others, or sampled. But then the tides usually can move them. But there are cases, especially I'm familiar with, and Mandy might be familiar with in Southeast, but in Cook Inlet, where they come near the towns of Kenai, or they're by the port of Alaska, and they are allowed to be moved with no authorization. And we don't also, you know, there's a worry about, especially in the summertime, not right now, is bears. You know, you don't want to be an attractive nuisance and attract bears to your neighborhood. So NOAA has allowed whales to be towed off the beaches. And in Cook Inlet particularly, the tides are pretty strong, so you just have to push them into the water, and then they're moved off, and then the tide will take it someplace else. But we have so many remote beaches, unlike places like Cape Cod or Florida, where they have to be really moved and towed or buried to remove these stranded animals.
Yeah.
Are you ever...
And there's logistical challenges, right? In Cook Inlet, it's challenging to get boats to be able to safely tow a carcass or to even move on the mudflats. So sometimes we just logistically, it's best to leave it in the environment and then the tides will take it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I suppose it's rare that you actually get to move a carcass into a refrigerated area so that you can work on it at your leisure.
Right. And dead horse will call up a couple different times, whether it's even a seal, a dead seal or a dead whale, because they don't want polar bears attracted to their fields.
Makes sense to me. Thank you so much to my guest, Natalie Rouse, a necropsy
Thank
biologist
you.
With Alaska Veterinary Pathology Services. Mandy Keough is the Alaska Regional Stranding Coordinator for NOAA, and Barbara Mahoney is the Assistant Stranding Coordinator for Western Alaska. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose, and on the phones, Wesley Early helped us out today. Thanks for listening. Have a great holiday Thanksgiving weekend. We'll be back next week. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.